So I'm going to start with something Freud said, of course. But what he said, which I picked up on, was, he said this in 1935, the story of my life and the history of psychoanalysis are intimately interwoven. And the fact that his founding text, The Interpretation of Dreams, is an autobiographical document is evidence that inner as well as outer worlds were part of its context. Like any other intellectual revolution, psychoanalysis could not have occurred in a cultural or scientific vacuum, but neither could it have occurred in a personal or in just a personal and emotional one. Notwithstanding my title this evening, which refers to hysteria, of course, my talk, I'm not going to say very much about the features of hysteria itself. I want instead to explore what I think is a gap in Freud's story, an episode in the history of psychoanalysis in which he saw those two worlds collide. The received history of psychoanalysis holds that Freud began his investigation into the baffling subject of hysteria without any preconceived ideas. At the end of the 19th century, the problem of hysteria, the illness that without any apparent organic injury or cause, displaying a variety of symptoms that included hallucinations, phobias, paralyses, and other things, presented a serious problem to medical thought. In line with the prevailing medical wisdom, Freud wrote in an article for the prestigious Villaret's Encyclopedia in 1888 that, quote, the cause of hysteria is to be looked for entirely in heredity. And these characteristics, he said, are nearly always to be found among preceding generations. Hysterics, he went on and insisted, are hereditarily disposed to nervous illnesses of some kind, and their characteristics will usually be found among their relatives and descendants. Trauma, by which he meant a physical or emotional injury of some kind, might initiate hysteria, he thought, but only in those already predisposed to it by heredity. All other factors, he wrote, play the part of incidental causes, the importance of which is, as a rule, overrated in practice. Sometime during the early 1890s, the exact date is uncertain, Freud abandoned this view. His biographer, Ernest Jones, tells us that he only gradually noticed and was quite unprepared for the emphasis on psychological factors such as sexual disorders in his patients' material. Jones quotes him as saying in 1889, I will only remark that in my case at least there was no preconceived opinion which led me to single out the sexual factor in hysteria. So much for the legend. With the publication in 1985 of the complete edition of Freud's letters to his friend Wilhelm Fliess, a different emphasis has emerged. It's been proposed that Freud's discovery that the disturbance of sexuality, of some kind or another, as a cause of hysteria, was less accidental than he would have us think. One biographer suggests that in an attempt to extend his general theory of neurosis, and drawing on work by the French psychiatrist Pierre Janet, on the role of ideas in hysteria, Freud began a deliberate search for the sexual causes of hysteria with the aim of placing it in the existing general theory of neurasthenia, an illness characterized by a host of vague symptoms, the so-called malnutrition of the nerves. The suggestion here is that Freud was actively searching for a problem that he could call his own. I want to look at this idea of a deliberate search because I believe Freud did, in fact, set out to find a sexual cause of hysteria, but that he did so even earlier than has been proposed. It's well known that as an ambitious and impoverished young doctor with a fast-growing family, son of a devoted but failed immigrant father from Galicia, Freud urgently needed to make his name. I'm going to suggest, however, that there was another reason, more personal and far more complex, for Freud's attempt to find a new cause for hysteria. And it was this reason that fueled what became an anxious and deliberate search for an alternative to the view that, as he had put it, the cause of hysteria is to be looked for entirely in heredity. Evidence shows that Freud not only decided that disturbances of sexuality were primary factors in hysteria earlier than has been proposed, but that he published his conclusion in a most unlikely place. In his translation into German of what were known as the Tuesday Lessons in 1892, these were the lectures of the famous French neurologist Jean-Martin Charcot, under whom he had studied in Paris in 1885 to 86. Freud suddenly and uncharacteristically broke with all convention. Without the author's permission, he appended to the text a large number of footnotes in which he criticized sharply Charcot's view that a hereditary predisposition was the underlying cause of a range of metabolic and neurological diseases that included epilepsy, diabetes, and gout, amongst others. Hysteria, Charcot insisted, was like these, a form of degeneracy, a member of what was known then, the famille, his what he was known for, the famille neuropathique, the neuropathic family. Charcot at that time was the most influential proponent of the doctrine of hereditary nervous disease. He taught that all other existing factors acted merely to trigger the neuropathic predisposition. Under this label were grouped all those diseases considered by his school to, quote, transform into one another as they were transmitted from one generation to the next, unquote. It's important to note that the Tuesday lessons, highly valued by Charcot's disciples, for their faithful rendering of his unique technique of investigation, were deemed essential to the understanding of the master's approach. The young Freud, who attended some of the lessons during his stay in Paris, attested to their accuracy, as well as to the persuasive power of the great man's personality. Charcot, in fact, had a profound effect on Freud, who described him as one of the greatest of physicians, a genius, who gave him a new perception of perfection. In the early days of the science of neurology, when mental illnesses were rarely distinguished from one another, the close attention paid by Charcot to the individual case, his teaching to his students to look at symptoms again and again, until, as he put it, they themselves began to speak, were rare practices that Freud never forgot. Writing in 1886, he recalled how, in the outpatient department in Berlin, where he'd worked for a while, a hysterical woman would have been as certain to be treated as a malingerer as in earlier centuries she would have been condemned as a witch. He said, once a diagnosis of hysteria was made, all interest on the part of physicians was withdrawn. Charcot, however, not only rescued hysteria from the discredit with which the term was identified, but also the physicians that treated it. Thanks to him, hysteria became almost overnight a perfectly respectable disease of the nervous system, a disease due to a congenital degeneration of the brain that could be subjected to serious study. The young Freud contrasted Charcot with Philippe Pinel, who during the French Revolution had released the poor madmen in the Salpêtrière from their chains. And although it was seen primarily as a woman's disorder, it was also from Charcot that Freud learnt about the frequency of hysteria in males, a feature of the disease then familiar only to the more enlightened German physicians. Freud's admiration for Charcot extended even to the point of naming his eldest son, Martin, after him. So we can only wonder at the uncharacteristic behaviour of the punctilious and scholarly Freud when, without permission or warning, he inserted his own objections into his translation of the great man's text. He hoped, he wrote in his preface to the lectures, that his, I quote him here, critical objections will not be understood as though I am trying in any way to set my views above those of my honoured teacher. Unquote. In fact, this is precisely what he sets out to do, laying before the reader in the footnotes themselves what he describes as an independent view of hysterical attacks, a view which not only undermines Charcot's theory of hysteria, but much of his remaining canon. His own new findings, Freud writes, in contradistinction to Charcot's, have shown that, and I'll quote this, at the core of a hysterical attack, in whatever form it may appear, is a memory, the hallucinatory reliving of a scene significant for the concept, for the onset of the illness. Where Charcot maintained that heredity was a primary cause of a patient's symptoms of hysteria, vertigo, and agoraphobia, Freud proposed instead that the more frequent cause lies not in heredity, but in abnormalities of sexual life. He conceded only that these illnesses occur more intensely in individuals with a hereditary disposition. Charcot's theory, Freud went on, fails to take account of the part played by acquired nervous diseases, which, he said, cannot be overestimated. Both hereditary disposition and psychic forces, he said, including sexual trauma, play a large part. And dismissing the central plank of Charcot's theoretical framework, the neuropathic family, Freud wrote, the whole idea barely stands up to serious criticism. It's in these critical objections and glosses of mid-1892 that we find Freud's earliest commitment to the idea of a central role played by unconscious psychic forces in illness, as well as a sexual theory of hysteria, the precursor, in fact, to the ideas that were later to herald the birth of psychoanalysis. Contrary to the view of many historians, it was these footnotes of mid-1892 that marked Freud's break with Charcot. In taking this anti-heredity direction, Freud plunged into what was then a heated debate in German medicine. The entire subject of hysteria, what caused it, whether it occurred in men as well as in women, even what constituted its symptoms, was highly controversial. The illness at that time had reached almost epidemic proportions, but because it had no demonstrable cause, was ideally designed to attract the vague, all-embracing diagnosis of hereditary degeneracy that was in vogue at the turn of the century. Although Freud never ruled out the influence of what he called heredity and constitution altogether, he was, working at a time when syphilis was rife. Connections were already being drawn between the disease in fathers and its effects in children. Dora's hysteria was attributed partly to the inherited effects of her father's syphilis, but as well as to the nervous pathology of her mother. So although Freud was by no means unique in believing that emotional and psychological factors played a central role in the formation of hysteria, his contention that hysteria could occur in the absence of any hereditary features, and that a predisposition to nervous illness was more likely to refer to early sexual experiences, flew in the face of all existing theories of inborn degeneracy. In other words, psychic mechanisms involved in hysteria were one thing. A A psychic etiology, or cause of hysteria, was quite another matter. Nevertheless, Freud's sudden reversal, his abrupt transformation from trusted disciple to sharp critic, under the privileged and protected guise of translator, is striking enough to suggest that a deep emotional investment was involved. He was, after all, reacting with a discourtesy unusual to him, to a by now familiar theory of heredity. In the event, relations between the two men, Charcot and Freud, cooled markedly after Freud's footnotes appeared. The tone in their letters changed to one of cordial formality. I'll say something more about that later. A state of affairs which remained unresolved at the time of Charcot's death the following year. So why was Freud so suddenly intent on dislodging the theory of heredity? Well, the argument that the different paradigms of two medical generations were at stake is surely correct. At the same time, as Macari points out, seismic shifts in the new theories of philosophy, science and medicine were dramatically changing the way Europeans were envisaging themselves. It might also be logical to assume that Freud's new theory of hysteria originated in the neuropathology, psychiatry, in which he was so deeply immersed. And this is certainly the view of many biographers who speak of the vision from those early roots, which from those early roots inspired him to go further. I want to suggest an explanation that takes into account a different aspect altogether of Freud's experience at that time. In late 20th century Vienna, the Jewish-Christian divide was central, politically, socially, and culturally. To the dismay of the Austrian Jewish population, Karl Luger, the pro-Catholic Christian socialist leader, had in the spring of 1897 been elected mayor of Vienna with a specifically anti-Semitic program. Freud, in fact, makes a caustic reference to the master of Vienna, Dr. Karl Luger, linking him with a cave resembling Dante's Inferno. Together with the continuing round of pogroms, blood libels were a constant feature of anti-Semitic agitation during this period. Their basis in Christian tradition was constantly reconfirmed by the popular priest Father Joseph Deckert, who tirelessly proclaimed from his Vienna pulpit that Jews murdered Christian children for ritual purposes. At the same time, the powerful Austrian Pan-Germanist movement, which surfaced at the end of the 1870s, and which rejected the multinational framework of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire in favour of the German folk, was by now in full swing. Its leader, George von Schönerer, who was later much admired by Hitler, repeatedly demanded that a sharp distinction be made between Aryans and Semites. Schönerer insisted on the eternal biological necessity, that's a quote, of combating the Jew, and campaigned for the exclusion and separation of Jews from professional, academic, and political life. Freud had already been warned at that time that for, quote, denominational reasons, unquote, he should not count on his long-awaited promotion to a professorship at the university. When Karl Luger joined forces with von Schönerer, anti-Semitism provided common ground between them. In addition, there was the ancient and hallowed association between the devil and the Jew, celebrated in legends, passions, and mystery plays, especially strong in Central European and Germanic cultures, of which no Jew of that time could have been ignorant. The cultural and political milieu was described by the writer Mark Twain, who, strangely enough, was living in Vienna at the time. He wrote, "Deputies in the Viennese Parliament, who came from all walks of life, from every grade of society, class, trade or profession. Although torn asunder by the fiercest nationalist and cultural jealousies, were united only in their hatred of Jews. Freud famously describes his encounter with this force on joining Vienna University as a medical student. He wrote, "When in 1873 I first joined the university, I experienced some appreciable disappointments. Above all, I found I was expected to feel myself inferior and an alien because I was a Jew. I refused absolutely to do the first of these things. I've never been able to see why I should feel ashamed of my descent, or, as people were beginning to say, of my race." With the words "of my race," Freud spells out the change in the perception of Jews, whose effects, I believe, were to bring him ultimately to the events described in this paper. By 1885, when he went to Paris to study under Charcot, religious and cultural anti-Semitism had given way to a more virulent biological form that stressed the ineradicably alien character of Jews, founded largely on the claim of degeneracy, a term that had by then come to have an especial association with Jews. If we take into account Freud's everyday experience at that time, a different explanation emerges. Events were taking place in the outside world, which not only had a bearing on developments in medical science, psychiatry and neurology in particular, but which helped determine their direction. Drawing on the works of George Moss and Sunder Gilman in particular, I'm going to try, briefly, to place these ideas in a social and political perspective and sketch out something of the climate of opinion in the medical science of Freud's day. In the post-Darwinian world of the late 19th century, psychiatry, as well as social thought and anthropology, were linked to Darwinian theories of natural selection and the survival of the fittest. Evolutionary theory was enthusiastically appropriated by medical science and aligned with the doctrine of the hereditary transmission of individual and racial characteristics. From this emerged the preoccupation with the inheritance of mental, physical and moral infection, which haunted 19th century science. The concept of degeneration, first formulated by French psychiatrist Benedict Morin in 1857, held that degenerations were, quote, "departures from the normal human type. Transmitted through inheritance, they led progressively to destruction," unquote. And as we saw with Charcot, the theory was extended to account for a whole spectrum of nervous and physical diseases. It led inevitably to an obsession on the part of medical and social theorists with the cleansing of the defective and criminal elements within society, and thence to movements calling to some degree or another for sterilizations, eugenics, and euthanasia. Scientists and physicians across Europe and the United States, or parts of the United States, blamed the condition of degeneration on the frenzied pace of contemporary life and the unnatural pressures of industrialization. The rapid growth of the large city was an important factor, as was the mental effort required to cope with steam and electricity, and the shocks, unnatural speed and noise of railway travel. Physician Max Nordau, more familiar to some of us today as one of Theodor Herzl's earliest supporters, whose book entitled Degeneration popularized the concept throughout Europe, diagnosed fatigue and exhausted brains, and also railway nerves, as the cause of the new nervous diseases. Nordau also found evidence of neuropathic traits in fin de siècle movements, in literature and art, and in the modern craving for constant stimuli, the new, the esoteric, and the perverse. Together with Morel and Nordahl, the Italian forensic psychiatrist anthropologist Cesare Lombroso helped establish doctrine of degeneration with his work on criminality. Lombroso taught that the condition was revealed by ungainly or asymmetrical features, such as protruding ears or noses, a sure sign of inherent degeneracy and probable criminality. Lombroso's theories praised the normal, the golden mean. All else was degenerate. More than anything else, the medical doctrine of degeneration appealed to a new wave of racist thought, which, with its emphasis on distinctions between inferior and superior, normal and abnormal, served to reinforce existing prejudices and preconceptions. Racism branded criminals, homosexuals, the insane, and predictably Jews as different and therefore abnormal. In this new science of racism that developed during Freud's early years, the rhetoric of religion, as Gilman puts it, couched in the language of 19th century science, shifted to the rhetoric of race, and the modern anti-Semitic image of the Jew was born. To this, the rising tide of nationalism added fuel. And while there were different theories about what made Jews what they were, consensus reigned on the general belief that they were dangerous and noxious. Meanwhile, Freud's Vienna from the late 1870s had seen rapid changes in the structure of its society. The challenges posed by industrialization, together with the massive immigration of Jews seeking relief both from Russian pogroms and the grinding poverty of Galicia, led to the rise of nationalism throughout the multi-ethnic Austro-Hungarian Empire. Changes that heralded the end of the old Austrian liberal order. In the popular literature, as well as among scientists in every field, anthropologists were particularly interested. This is a quote: "A restless striving for profits and heightened sensuality were features often seen to account the higher percentage of mental and nervous illness among Jews as a whole." Unquote. Restlessness itself was a key quality in the image of the Jewish neurosis. It's hard to exaggerate the extent to which this image gripped the scientific as well as the popular imagination of Freud's world. Schalko himself classified a neuropathy of travelling and nomadism, unquote, to which Jews were racially predisposed. He supervised a doctoral thesis, later to become a popular book, in which the wandering Jew, pictured in Christian legends in eternal flight from the site of Christ's suffering at Calvary, is described as the prototypical neuropathic Jew. The author proposed that together with a general predisposition to hereditary neurological disorders of all sorts, vagabondage was a specific Jewish neurological disorder. And as faithfully recorded by the then obedient Freud in his translation of Charcot's Leçon du Mardi of 1889, Charcot himself subscribed to this belief with what he described as the Jewish neuropathy of nomadism, helpfully introducing to his disciples and pupils a limping neurasthenic Jew, a Hungarian patient called Klein, suffering from what Schalko said was travel mania, and employing for him the medieval Christian name for the wandering Jews. He said, or he introduced him with the words, "I introduce him to you as a true descendant of Ahasuerus or Kartophilus." By now, Charcot's fame as a neurologist, his pioneering work with steering, and his international reputation as a consulting physician of kings and princes had established him as its leading European voice. So influential had he become that, to mention one example, in Edouard Brumont's 1886 book, La France Juive, probably the most virulently anti-Semitic tract to be published before Hitler's Mein Kampf, the author was able to draw extensively on Charcot's work. Drumont's book, credited by many historians with setting the stage for the Dreyfus affair, cited Charcot's study on degenerative disease in Jews to huge public and critical acclaim. Jews were widely seen as prone to hysteria, neurasthenia, perverse sexual practices of one kind or another, and potentially to insanity. By the late 1890s, they'd become the common topic of medical discussion. For Professor Krafft-Ebing of the Faculty of Medicine in Vienna, who to his credit did later propose Freud for a professorship, the Orthodox Jew was the quintessential neurasthenic. These illnesses, he wrote, affect the Jews with exceptional severity. Their preoccupation with mystical religious practices, the custom of endogenous marriage, which was a common euphemism for inbreeding, and once again, their intense preoccupation with commerce, were the precipitating causes. Krafft-Ebing's theory was buttressed by German professor of psychiatry Simson, who held the view that, quote, there is a neurotic quality which runs through the whole race in spite of all abilities and perseverance in their occupations, unquote. Episodes of mental illness are also triggered in them by economic failure, he wrote. The association of the Jew with psychopathology was undisputed. Religious and cultural differences had found medical explanation. By the end of the century, the idea of the hysteric was closely bound to the idea of the Jew, including the male Jew. However, the doctrine of Jewish degeneration was not restricted to Germany and Austria. Following the influential Lombroso's criteria for born criminals, scientists throughout Western Europe tried to capture the Jewish physiognomy. In London, for example, Francis Galton went down to the East End and photographed boys in the Jews' free school to find an image of the essence of the Jew. He reported finding a, quote, cold, scanning gaze, unquote, in the children, which he designated as the sign of their potential pathology. Medical analysis of Jews had legitimized the Jewish stereotype, and the iconography of hysteria, popularized by Charcot, was by the 1890s neatly aligned with a new racist concept of degeneration. Although it may be salutary to recall that in England, as it became apparent that you had to be more careful about designating racial inferiority in the lower classes, the chair of eugenics set up at London University in the early 1900s was retitled Sociology. Jewish medical scientists were inevitably deeply involved in the debate, desperately trying to be scientific, struggling at the same time with their own tortured sense of identity. They found themselves to be, in Gilman's words, both subject and object, the object of the gaze of study and the subject studying. The gaze of the Jewish physician was itself pathologized. Like their Christian colleagues, Jewish physicians did not, on the whole, question the fact of degeneration as the hereditary source of mental illness, nor did they dispute the Jewish predisposition to it. Some Jewish scientists insisted the illness was real, but mitigated the charge of inherited difference by invoking social trauma with the stigmata impressed on their minds and bodies by the generations in the ghetto. The playwright Arthur Schnitzler, who as a young doctor was inspired by Charcot's work, Max Nordau, whose doctoral thesis was supervised by him, and who drew heavily on his doctrines for his book, Degeneration, César Lombroso, and Maurice Fischberg were all Jewish physicians. As Aaron Appelfeld shows so vividly in his book, I think it's called Blooms of Darkness, his most recent one, the Viennese Jewish bourgeoisie tended mainly to ascribe Jewish degeneration to the newly arrived Eastern Jews, the insular Yiddish-speaking Ostjuden, with their Talmudic dialectic and ghetto mentality, thus projecting onto the perceived primitive other what was being projected onto them. Until his eruption in his footnotes to the Tuesday lessons, Freud, like his Jewish colleagues, subscribed unhesitatingly to the prevailing orthodoxy of the tainted, neuropathic Jewish family, although remarkably, considering the widespread influence of the doctrine among Jewish and Gentile scientists alike, he never referred publicly to the Jewish issue at all. Like them, however, he was briefly, anxiously aware of his own proximity to the problem. As a young man, he'd succumbed to it very briefly when, in a letter from Paris to his fiancée in 1886, he confessed his concern about, I have to quote this, the hereditary taint among cousins in my father's Eastern European family. But, he said, these stories are very common in Jewish families. It was against this background of hereditary Jewish predisposition to neuropathic and other diseases that Freud's theory of neurosis evolved. So when exactly did he turn away from the received scientific wisdom to write those contentious footnotes? Interestingly, we find that Freud's first mention of a sexual cause of hysteria comes in mid-1892 with the first lecture that he translated, the first lecture of Charcot's Leçon. It comes abruptly and with unusual force in response to Charcot's repeated emphasis on the pronounced susceptibility in Jewish families to a wide range of hereditary diseases that included hysteria, diabetes, epilepsy, and others. Perverse sexual practices as well, and other members of his neuropathic family. Charcot's response to Freud's footnotes and to the changes he made in them came in his letter, in his letter of June the 30th. And I'm quoting Charcot now. "I'm delighted," he wrote, "with your notes and criticisms, which I found at the bottom of my leçon. It's perfect. Long live liberté, as we say here in France." This letter was first taken to be evidence of Charcot's approval of Freud's ideas, but a fuller presentation has shown it's the exact opposite. The great man then proceeds, obviously miffed, to spell out to his rebellious Jewish translator the Jewish predisposition to an even longer list of diseases. Quote, "Well, take a look. The exploration is easy, especially in Jewish families," he wrote, adding, in another allusion to the supposed Jewish custom of inbreeding, in which the suggestion of incest is never far away. Charcot's rancor in this angry letter is also apparent in his use of the vulgar Juif rather than the polite Israelite or the scientific Semite that he previously and customarily used in his scientific discourse. Freud's disingenuous about his footnotes to the Tuesday lessons concealed a purpose that was more important to him than either literary or scientific convention, more important even than his relationship to the influential Charcot. The close and exacting work of translation must have demanded of him a deep understanding, perhaps an initial identification with Charcot's views. After all, not only did he admire him greatly, he also needed the work. He had written excitedly to his fiancée Martha in Paris of his commission to translate Charcot's book into German. He said it would be a great advantage to the new practice. In the event, what seems to have happened is that, gratified at the opportunity, Freud then found himself caught up in the translation of theories, spelling out the predisposition of Jews, like himself, to a wide range of hereditary characteristics and diseases that condemn them to moral, mental, and physical inferiority. Moreover, he was translating them for the benefit of the German-speaking scientific world, in which he knew to his own cost, anti-Semitic prejudice was deeply embedded. There seems to have been a dawning recognition in Freud of the logical consequences of Charcot's theories, consequences from which he had to distance himself. The theory of heredity, he saw, singling out, as it did, a unique inborn tendency in Jews to disease and deficiency, imprisoned them in a hopeless, degrading, and, as important to him, unscientific stereotype, which he hadn't seen, but which had not been traumatic at the time as a young man, but which awakened earlier traumatic ones. I think trauma theory would have something to say about that long gap between them. Anyway, with his unauthorized footnotes, which he knew must alienate him from his powerful mentor, Freud was able to distance himself from Charcot's doctrine. It was a separation that clashed with his pressing ambition to gain professional advancement. However, his opposition to Charcot on the painful and humiliating question of the hereditary Jewish taint now seems to have provided the impetus for a search for a concept of nervous illness tied not to particular but to universal human truths. Freud's recognition of the implications for Jews of Charcot's theories and his deliberate rejection of them enabled him to make some kind of intuitive leap in turning at this moment towards the central role of unconscious instinctual life in the neuroses. Freud turned towards the beginnings of a universal theory of human development and anxiety, one that would emphasize the dependence of all human beings, regardless of race, on their unconscious instinctual sexual lives. I think that's a repeat. Anyway, some 3 years later, with Charcot safely in his grave, he spelled it out in his essay, Heredity and the Etiology of the Neurosis, written in French, and addressed in particular to the disciples of Jean-Martin Charcot. The courage of these footnotes, as well as their disingenuousness, have only recently been recognized. The importance to Freud of internal truth, his refusal to collude with the great man's views and with the persuasive anti-Semitic dogma of the scientific world, are evident throughout this strange and obscure affair. He was far from being unaware of his inappropriate behavior. In 1901, rather sheepishly, he confessed, quote, I really did infringe the rights of property that applied to publications. I added notes to the text without asking the author's permission. And some years later, I had reason to believe that he was displeased with my action. I've emphasized the meaning to Freud of the factor of the hereditary disposition and the implications for him. State. Although it's far from being the sole factor behind the birth of psychoanalysis, it almost has certainly helped to give momentum to Freud's need to understand and document the cause of neurosis. It helped to pave the way for psychoanalysis in that it challenged the sense of a foreordained hopeless inferiority. But it also, to quote Macaulay once again, it also helped to win for science the traditional object of humanistic culture, the inner life of human beings, and the idea that something can happen in the body that might not be accessible to the mind. I've said little in this paper about Freud's inner world, focusing instead on the sequence of external events, but I contend it's a mistake to believe that he was affected by the climate of anti-Semitism only to the extent that he himself describes. In a certain sense, his many almost formal references to it, such as the appreciable disappointments he suffered at university, which I quoted earlier, serve as a kind of red herring, diverting attention from some of its more complex effects. One of Freud's last patients in Vienna, Roy Grinker, his name was, wrote that Freud never overcame the trauma which anti-Semitism brought upon him. The helplessness of Jews in the face of the relentless, humiliating, and disempowering denigration that was a permanent feature of the world in which Freud's identity was formed was infinitely more traumatic than Freud ever acknowledged, perhaps more even than has been allowed for by historians. The deeply ambivalent feelings that Jews have for their past and their curious relationship to historical research forms an important topic in its own right and is a major theme in modern Hebrew literature. It's been explored, in particular by Yosef Yerushalmi, who points out that while often gripped by an aching nostalgia for a vanished Jewish past, many Jews do not want the past that's offered them by the historian. I call it the fiddler on the roof syndrome. The remote or mythic past is infinitely preferable. The student of Freud's work is ideally placed to see this ambivalence, for example, in his two passionate but fanciful accounts of Moses, if he bears in mind at the same time how he consistently denied any knowledge of Hebrew or Yiddish. The latter was literally his mother tongue, which his mother spoke. His mother spoke a Galician Yiddish to the end of her life. And he learned Hebrew at school for years under a teacher who was a loved and influential friend. So this denial, together with his striking facility for other languages, must have served defensive purposes. While Freud was driven to discover the source of hysteria, and with it a universal theory of neurosis, he was moved not only by his own struggle to understand the complex relationship between fantasy and reality, but also by feelings of humiliation, rage, and a sense of injustice, which, although partly acknowledged by him, are not traditionally associated with the development of his thought at that time. I want to end this talk with an observation made recently by Elie Zaradsky, that while a great deal has been said about the influence of Freud's Judaism on his life and work, we know far less about the influence of Freud himself on Jewish history. One early example of this must be a little-known episode in the immediate aftermath of World War I, when some 400,000 Jews from Eastern Europe, forced by pogroms to flee Galicia, arrived in Vienna. Inspired, ironically as it turns out, by the burgeoning German youth movement, the Wandervogel, and its message to its members to discard their parents' bourgeois values, leave home, and return to nature. Some 600 Jewish adolescents, calling themselves Hashomer HaTzair, the Young Guards, emigrated between 1919 and 1923 to what was then Palestine. From makeshift work camps, these socialist Zionist pioneers set out to achieve a transformation of identity, primarily by severing their ties with their parents' world. Their aim was to become new Jews, Jews who would be the antithesis of their parents, both the European ghetto Jew of the East and the so-called assimilated Jews of the West. The antithesis, in fact, of the Jews of the European diaspora. And it's here that psychoanalysis enters Jewish history. Freud's significance to these young pioneers was such that, as Chaim Weizmann told Ernest Jones, "I have no idea how those two met." They arrived without clothes, but with a copy of Freud's The Interpretation of Dreams under one arm and Das Kapital under the other. They believed that Marxism was the solution to problems between people, while psychoanalysis was the remedy for ills within them. Hashomer Tzair ultimately developed into an organized political party, and inevitably splits emerged between the different wings of the movement, but not before psychoanalytic libraries were established, and a psychoanalytic publishing house that translated and disseminated psychoanalytic concepts were founded. But the pioneers of Shomer Tzair were not the only or even the first ones to have sought emancipation from a role in which, as some Jews were beginning by then to say, Jews were allowing themselves to be cast. Max Nordau's speech at the first Zionist Congress in 1897 in Bonn portrayed entire Jewry as physically and spiritually alien. Everywhere, he said, there exists a Jewish affliction in a form unknown to other people. Nordau's diagnosis of the Jewish malady, coming from so well-known a medical authority, reduced many of the delegates to tears. He thought that degeneration was both a physiological and a psychological disease of the nervous system, whose remedy, instead of remaining slaves to their nerves, was to become men of muscle. At the second Congress, held in the shadow of the Dreyfus trial, Nordau proposed that an immediate fitness program for Jewish youth be established, and he called for a new Jewry that would straighten us in body and mind. His view of the inherent relationship between the healthy political mind and the healthy body became a commonplace of early Zionist literature. In an important sense, Nordau's image of a new Jewish body became the symbol for the new Jewish nation and state. Tragically, Freud lived just long enough to see the consequences of the theories of heredity and degeneration begin to be used against Jews once again, this time to more dreadful effect than ever before. Some 40 years later, the doctrines that Freud had struggled so hard to oppose had become the main staple of racist theory. Perhaps he noticed the grim irony in the fact that the main architects of the doctrine, Max Nordau and Cesare Lombroso, were also fellow Jews.
Lombroso.
Yeah. Because at one point you were saying that they were agreeing with the degeneracy idea, but at the same time there seemed to come in some kind of sociological aspect of, you know, life in the ghetto. And I mean, how did those two...
It was a question of time. By the time things had progressed and anti-Semitism had become completely vitriolic, Nordau changed his... His idea of degeneration remained, but his solution for it became Zionism. And he allied himself with Herzl.
And the idea was somehow that generations of life in the ghetto would produce some kind of degenerate... Some of them said that.
Some of them believed that that would somehow mitigate. But it was never a scientific thing. It was an attempt to distract from the idea of inheritance,
yeah,
and put it down to experience.
But they still agree. That's what I'm driving at. There seemed to be still an agreement about the idea of inheritance, at the same time as trying to, as you say, mitigate that with a sense of some kind of traumatic inheritance.
I think they did. Nordau, in fact, kicked off the whole thing with his book on degeneration, and he was absolutely convinced of it. He turned. He changed. And the anti-Semitism was partly responsible.
I mean, the reason why I'm asking is because, you know, today you've got, you know, more, you know, black people are more likely to end up on psychotropic drugs, be sectioned, be, you know, so there's a whole set of, and you could say, you know, you could produce a theory, a racial theory, obviously, for that, or you could produce, you know, a theory of that, you know, society is to blame, that people are being stigmatised.
You could either.
Black. It's an aspect of racism. Or you could say that racism drives people mad. That actually, you know, perhaps there is something about living in that structure which may produce more sort of schizophrenic outcome. You know, I don't know. You know,
but it's still being debated, isn't it? And when people like, was it Murray who talked about the, it is still being, I don't think this has ever been settled. Yeah. It's still being debated. It's nature or nurture, or we have the same debate with and when you talk about, but I mean, now the Muslim thing has come into it as well.
Yeah.
Muslim kind of anti-Semitism. What seems to be common to all of the debates.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about that. I mean, is there any, I can't think of a kind of idea of neuropathology attached to Muslim. Yeah, is there? Kind of sense, you know, similarly to what you were describing in the Jewish.
You mean they wouldn't have done that? It wouldn't have been done. They wouldn't. That wouldn't. That particular thing would not have happened with Muslims.
Well, has it happened? I mean, I'm just trying to think whether today we have a sense, you know, whether there is a kind of undercurrent of, I mean, it's certainly Islamophobia and all the rest of it. But is there a sense of some kind of ascription? You know, attached to an ethnic cultural group that is about some kind of psychopathology. I mean,
I think it's more a case of the religion of Islam, of what the Quran said.
Yeah.
And that it's not an inheritance, it's a religious matter.
But there's something similar said of the Jews.
Well, the inheritance idea with the Jews, as you know, cuts off, goes back much, much further. It wasn't just the ghetto, it goes back to Christ.
The Middle Ages and Christ.
Christ.
Well, Muslims tend to marry their cousins, which is not so great for the National Health Service. Yeah. Because obviously all those diseases, there are various diseases, I forgot what they are. A certain amount of attention to deal with expenses involved.
Mm.
But it doesn't. I've heard that before, and there's been articles in the newspaper about it, and it's kind of a thing that in the Muslim community they're kind of concerned about. But it's always on the physical level, isn't it? You know, it doesn't seem to ever have been this kind of crossover. We've now ascribing that to some kind of psychological degeneracy. That's what I mean.
There are characteristics ascribed.
Well, it is important.
There are characteristics ascribed to what it to Christians, overexcited and likely to explode. I mean, they're all sort of. Are they not? I don't know.
I think those characteristics definitely ascribed to West Indians. But I haven't noticed them ascribed to.
The Arab nations.
There'll
always
be
a war,
yes, that
is. There'll always be a war with each other.
Well,
I'm not suggesting it's true, I'm just suggesting that
there's no connotation of racism in that, is there? There are lots of the Jews, also connected with the race, with Muslims. I mean, there's vast numbers of people from everywhere, so it's difficult to attribute any racist characteristics to that.
Yes,
what I was interested in was the extent to which it has, to some of these ideas, for example, hysteria in Jews, to the extent to which it still exists, if only in the collective imagination. And I'll read this because it was so apt. And an example I was particularly fond of was Julie Burchill, who in the immediate wake of the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, complained in her column. She said, for Israel to behave as though it were the first country ever to experience a political assassination only adds weight to the unpleasant theories about Jews and Jewish hysteria and their ability to make a self-flagellating drama out of any minor crisis.
A bit like what Boris Johnson said about the Republicans, isn't it?
I was interested that the idea had survived.
But the German
amazing.
Made
I mean,
something different.
What?
Her usage of the word hysteria is not the same as
this.
Probably,
it's
but still.
But you wouldn't popular colloquial. I think that's incredible, really.
Yeah. I did. I've kept it for a long time, yeah. Hoping to use it.
Yes,
so
I mean,
quite surprising.
It's very antiquated.
Well, that doesn't seem to help, does it? I mean,
I think it's said time in cheek, actually.
It wasn't. It was one of her columns. It was at that time. And I think she mentioned it.
Don't you think there's a paradox, though, in the Jewish identity? Because think about it. The Jews in Germany were the most integrated, or viewed themselves as incredibly integrated into German society. And yet they were still carrying out their family lives in a rather Jewish tradition, so there was a paradox of identity, something that had a connotation of the outsider.
I think that's always been the case, and that is precisely what inspired the foundation of the state of Israel. I mean, it was at its highest in Freud's time, we thought, but of course then it got worse and worse. It's hard to actually look back and see where there wasn't that kind of identity topic for Jews. Certainly in Germany it was always there. I think Austria was more liberal up until the point I mentioned. And then all hell broke loose.
I was just going to say, I think that the theory that you proposed tonight is very, very interesting, that his very complex attitude to his own Jewish identity propelled him to finding a new explanation for hysteria. That's fascinating. And also in his relationship to Jung, his Jewishness was extremely important because he saw Jung as a potential disciple, as a Christian, who could take the Jewish science of psychoanalysis into the world and make it respectable. Of course, that all broke down. And also, he also was very affected, wasn't he, by this story of what happened to his father, who, when he was a child, he remembered that his father was forced to step into the gutter to let a Gentile pass. I can't remember the exact story, but it was something like that, wasn't it? And that was a seminal memory for him. I haven't really got a question, I'm sorry, I'm just sort of commenting.
Yeah, it's true, it was a seminal thing.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's thought by some people he never recovered from.
I think there's a slight difference, though, between thinking about, you know, the influence of Jewish identity, and that has a certain connotation, and you know, what Estelle's really talking about, the influence of racism.
Oh,
absolutely. You know, and that's, and of course they're linked, but it is a different kind of...
Yes, but the complexity of his Jewish identity was such that when he married Martha, for example, he absolutely said his condition was there would be no Jewish Sabbath in the house. He wouldn't let her light candles. So it's very interesting that it was so seminal in his life, but in such a complex and contradictory way, too. I'm not disputing what you said at all, it's actually true.
He didn't encourage his children to lose their Jewish identity.
No, and he considered himself to be very Jewish. And he had, you know, Jewish jokes were not jokes, and Jewish jokes were a
title, stereotype. Mm. You know, and when you're in that structure and you are the object of stereotyping, you know, then of course you have to think, you know, a particular question. And the question is, who do they think I am? Mm. Or who does that person think I am? You know, and that question, you know, is obviously the question of transference.
Of
transference. I mean, that Freud, as a therapist, has continually to ask himself, who does that person, the patient, think I am? Mm. You know, and maybe, you know, there's something about the structure of this therapy that he created that's also connected to the
that's interesting
aspects. Mm. Well, just but he's creating a structure where he's allowing or trying to promote the patient to project onto him. No, but that's what he's been living in the whole of his life, you know, because he's a Jew with these characteristics and with this cultural switch and these stereotypes. And how you sort of work, you know, how you figure out what's going on, you know, that's a kind of continual thing that somebody, you know, you're growing up working that out.
I'd like to say something. Thank you for tonight's paper. I have been waiting to hear a paper like this for some time.
Really?
Yes, mm-hmm. I have, actually.
Why?
Why? Because I think that the external world does impact on one's internal world. There's no way around that, and I don't think it's spoken about enough. But I wondered whether you had some thoughts. I think these things are very difficult to talk about, and I wondered whether you had some thoughts about the role of fear, what that did to people over time.
In Freud's time?
Pretty
or in general?
You know, hundreds of years, really. Persecution. Or continuous persecution.
Well, that's a big question. Obviously.
I am interested in... I have been struggling to figure out what happened psychically, and I had a thought which I've written about. I had a thought that that levels of fear tend to be higher among people who are persecuted, who feel persecuted from external forces, which they have no possibility of being able to do anything about. And I wondered whether it affects their ability to deal with the Oedipus complex.
With what?
The Oedipus complex. With the resolution of the Oedipus complex.
Well, what you say about fear having a pronounced, I mean, one can't dispute that. But it makes me think of something said by Shasuke Smilga, who is talking about, in fact, he's talking about Freud and other people of his time. I mean, there were some great, there were writers that he particularly, like Stefan Zweig and Schnitzler. What she says is, though, and it acts as it's a sort of kind of warning. She says, well, to some extent, of course, to a certain extent, certainly in the unconscious, we are all actually some of the things that we're being called. We are all greedy, we are all deficient in one way or another, we are all traumatized to that extent. And it must have some effect. So your question, persecution, it can't go nowhere. It's either got to remain or survive in the person, which is what she says it does to some extent, or it's got to be disowned. And of course there's a price to pay for that too. So I mean, I don't think there is an answer to your question. I'm just acknowledging. And I think probably the extent to which the person is affected depends on his or her own, and his own state of mind. But you can't possibly deny the effect. And I think that the effect would be...
I think it is denied.
Are you thinking of any particular group?
I think it is denied in relation to black people in this society.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I think it is denied in relation to black people in this society.
Really?
I'm thinking of people from a slavery background.
Yes, I think that's a really interesting point, actually. Slavery. Can you say a bit more about that?
Just in situations where the couple has been deliberately interfered with, and their mothers and children are separated.
Are you talking about historically or now?
Well, I think it's around the room. Some of it is around the room.
And what do you...
My evidence for that is the prevalence of single-parent families. Are able to come together.